Hello, and welcome to Traffic at Europe Radio. My name is Clayton McKee, and I'm looking forward to presenting you part two of a conversation with Jordan Kutzik. Jordan is a law student, a publisher of Yiddish literature, and a translator. Today, rather than focusing on Yiddish in general, we are going to turn specifically to Jordan's translation of Boris Sandler's short story, The Old Well Underneath the Old Walnut Tree. The story was published in our winter 2024 issue, Essential New Literature of Lesser-Known Languages of Europe. You can find a link in our show notes, or go to www.trafficaeurope.org to check it out. Boris was not available for an interview, but he was able to respond to written questions. The questions and answers were translated into and out of Yiddish by Jordan Kutzik. TE veteran Joe Williams will be voicing Boris Sandler throughout this interview. Before we get into this episode, I wanted to take a moment and remind everyone that there is a Patreon page for Traffica Europe. You can go to patreon.com/trafficaeurope. We have been publishing audio excerpts and extras for our members on that page. Take a look if you're interested. A special shout out to our most recent member, Thomas Carroll. Thanks for your support, Thomas. With that, let's get into this episode. We heard an introduction from Jordan last week, so check out the link in the show notes to go back and listen to his introduction, as well as all of the wonderful information that he provided us about Yiddish literature and publishing. This episode will start with an introduction of Yiddish author Boris Sandler.
My name is Boris Sandler. I was born in 1950 in the Moldovan city of Bolpi, which in Yiddish is called Belts. 2 years before I was born, Stalin's regime began a vicious assault on Yiddish culture and Yiddish literature. Hundreds of Yiddish writers and cultural workers were arrested and deported to gulags. 2 years after I was born, 13 members of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee were sentenced to death, among them 5 leading Yiddish writers. I mention this to emphasize that my generation of Soviet Jews born after the Holocaust, was raised without a national cultural foundation. Instead, we grew up in a repressive atmosphere of state-sponsored anti-Semitism and a hypocritical ideology of supposed brotherhood between the peoples of the Soviet Union. My knowledge of the minority language, Yiddish, comes from my home, where my parents and grandparents spoke Yiddish amongst themselves. I taught myself to read and write Yiddish from the lessons that were printed in the Moscow-based Yiddish literary journal, Sovetish Heimland, or Soviet Homeland, which existed from 1961 to 1991. After being a professional musician for more than 30 years, I graduated from an advanced program at the Gorky Literature Institute in Moscow, which included a special section for Yiddish editors, and thereafter began dedicating myself more and more to writing prose. From then until 1992, when I emigrated from Moldova, 2 of my books of prose were published in Moscow, Yiddish and Russian editions of Stairway to a Miracle. In Jerusalem, I was active as a writer, was the founder and editor of a Yiddish language literary journal for children, Kind und Kind, which means roughly for young and old, and worked at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem as part of a project researching the interwar Yiddish press. Another 2 of my prose books for adults appeared during my time in Israel, The Old Well and Gates, as well as a volume of rhyming couplets for children entitled Nicht Gestoigen, Nicht Gefloigen. The title is a very difficult to translate idiom, but it roughly means It Didn't Happen That Way or It's an Old Wives' Tale. The book later appeared in English as Tall Tales About Animals with Tails. In 1998, after being recruited to become the editor-in-chief of the venerable Yiddish newspaper Der Vorwärts, Forward, I settled in New York. After serving that position for 18 years, I retired and founded an international monthly online literary journal and publishing house, Yiddish Brands. The name means roughly the Yiddish line of work. So far, I have published 27 books of my own prose and poetry, which includes volumes in the original Yiddish and ones translated into English, Russian, German, and other languages. I have also published 13 books in Yiddish by younger writers through my publishing house and directed a series of 10 documentary films. Monologues by Yiddish writers. I live with my wife in Brooklyn. We have 2 sons and 7 grandchildren.
We heard a bit about Yiddish last week in terms of publishing and its spread. Jordan, do you happen to translate from any other languages or just Yiddish?
So I was a Spanish major in college, and I actually took translation and literary translation courses taught in Spanish or for Spanish English with the hope of learning how to do it to be able to do it in Yiddish, but I've never actually translated much from Spanish, but in a pinch I could, but most of my Spanish translation has been medical forms, legal documents, more kind of technical things.
This next part is going to concentrate a bit more on Boris, but this will hopefully add some further information to all of the amazing information that Jordan provided us last week. Boris, I see that you grew up in what is today called Moldova, where you first learned Yiddish and you later went to Moscow for graduate studies in Yiddish literature. You then spent time in New York and are now living in Israel. How did these settings influence your writing and your use of Yiddish language?
One of my books is a short story collection, Antiques from My Travel Bag. Nearly all of its characters, who mostly came from the same regions as me, were forced to leave their homes during the 1970s to the early 1990s and set off wandering. They carried their only luggage, their memories of the old country, and everything connected to it in their well-worn travel bags. Finding oneself in a new environment puts immigrants in the state of being constantly torn between the contradictions of their past and their present. This internal and external conflict, which exists at the border of reality and unreality, lies at the heart of my work. Yiddish is a very flexible language, which has in essence absorbed the best flavours of the languages which Ashkenazi Jews have heard and used during their long diaspora.
When people think of Yiddish literature, they often think of older texts and have trouble imagining anything contemporary, despite there being populations of Yiddish speakers in Montreal, New York, London, and of course Israel. Have you faced any obstacles as a contemporary writer due to that assumption?
It's very unfortunate, but the majority of secular Jews are not well versed in their own national heritage, including Jewish history and literature. If you are referring to the religious communities around the world where Yiddish is spoken, it is for them primarily a language of communication, and they don't care about Yiddish literature. This is despite the fact that among the great inheritance left to us by Yiddish writers are many works of religious literature, especially poetry. As editor of the Vorwärts, I've introduced a new column featuring the works of Hasidic authors in an effort to attract more religious readers to the newspaper. Of course, these authors had to sign their articles with a pseudonym, so they wouldn't, heaven forbid, be caught writing in the paper by members of their community. If they had been caught, they would have been in big trouble. A Yiddish writer, in any case, should try to concern himself as little as possible with what his readers think about Yiddish literature in general and his own works in particular.
Without trying to get too political about the matter, I read that there was a contention between Hebrew and Yiddish upon the establishment of Israel, some believing that a shared common language would solidify the nation, whereas others preferred reserving Hebrew to spirituality and Yiddish to worldly life. Why do you find it important to continue writing in Yiddish?
I previously mentioned the language war against Yiddish in Israel. Even in the 1950s, it was forbidden to perform Yiddish theatre in Israel. When Hebrew University in Jerusalem inaugurated a department to study Yiddish literature in Hebrew translation, its opponents distributed leaflets saying that Yiddish is a catastrophe of biblical proportions for Israeli culture. Later came a period of indifference. No one, including Israel's intellectuals, was bothered by the fact that an important part of their wider national culture was vanishing. Just recently, Yiddish PL, the only Yiddish theatre in Israel, was shuttered and more than 70 people lost their jobs because the government decided to stop providing funding for it. In the Soviet Union, my choice to create in Yiddish and not in Russian appeared not just strange but frankly insane. I actually wrote my first stories in Russian, but I switched as soon as I understood that my characters would not read naturally if they were to exist in any language besides Yiddish, even if they spoke Russian on a daily basis. Their thoughts and feelings were too Jewish. Now, after more than 40 years of writing in Yiddish, I can safely say that ultimately it was not I who chose Yiddish, but Yiddish which chose me.
What are some of your inspirations in literature, whether Yiddish or not? What are some other Yiddish writers that you think our audience should know about?
Among the first Yiddish writers who brought me into the world of Yiddish literature was my literary mentor, Yekiel Schreibman. Russian literature, of course, has had a great influence on me. First and foremost, Isaac Babel, Ivan Bunin, and Mikhail Bulgakov. Among Yiddish prose writers, David Bergelson and Der Nichter, and among Yiddish poets, Osher Schwarzman and Itzik Manja. Among the Western writers who have greatly influenced my work are William Faulkner, Heinrich Theodor Böll, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Before we talk a bit about the old well underneath the old walnut tree, let's hear a reading of a part of the story. This reading will be first in the original Yiddish, and then we will hear the English translation. Both will be read by translator Jordan Kutzik.
Der alte Brunnen unter den alten Nussenbäumen von Boris Sandler. Eiscreme. Nur das Wort allein, a viele an dem, ich soll dem Eiscreme versuchen. Im Elektron, dir fielen dich bald mit der Zung, dem süßen Brie. Pflegt sich es, machaie dich zu schmelzen in Mäuel und treiben die Slinge. Es aber tamt, putter Schokoladene Wort Eiscreme. Es geht sich in jeden Ever. In Chutsch, das Geschmack auf Wort ist mir ständig gelegen auf der Zung, ist es wie auf Soloches, geknippt und gebunden mit ein anderes Wort, Angine. Auch das prickere, bittere Wort, was hat gehabt in eingestandenem Optik-Reich, ist befährisch euch damit gelegen auf der Zung, nur schon nicht bei mir, bei meinen Mamen. Mame, ich will Eiscreme. Mehr gar nicht. Hast du erst gehabt, es als schwere Rangine? Ja, die zwei epochdicke Wärter haben sich geport zwischen sich wie jene neue Stiefelich. Das rechte Stiefelde ist akkurat auf mein Fiesel. Geh und spring und läuf. Das linke quetsch mir aber so un, als ich kann kein Span nit machen. Ich muss die ganze Zeit unterbegen die Finger. Einmal, grad in mitten Sommer, lieg ich in mein Bettle, der Hals ist mir herumgewickelt mit der Mames wollener Fatschelle, was hat zwei große Meiles. Sie waren wie eine gut angeheizte Grube, und bei sich, wir machten ausgehungerte Maraschkes. Und die Mama delangt mir auf ein Terrel, auf Waffelbecherl. Versteht sich, nicht kein Ledigs. Das Herz hat mir ein Tioche getan. Punkt in eine solche Waffelbecherlach verkauft man Eiscreme. Bei der dichtlichen Freude in einer weißen, angekramalierten Fartig mit zwei Reutebäckelech auf ein keiligdichen Punnen, was handelt mit Eiscreme in einer kleinen Fanierstiebel, ähnlich auf einem Starrenschlag, seinen die ledige Waffelbäckelech ausgelegt auf eine Polizei Schoritzweis, ein Becherl in ein Becherl. Mit dem Löffel fiel die Freude an das waffelige Becherl mit Eiscreme, stellte sie weg auf der rechte Schal von der Waage und warf dich jedes Mal kosse Blicken auf den tanzendicken Weiser, hielt sie erst an mit dem Löffel abzusuppen von der Portion sticklich Eiscreme. Ich steh beim viereckigen Fensterl von der anderen Seite Waage und halt sich kaum ein. Schön! Genug ist euch viel Suppen. Sie wird mir doch gar nicht bleiben. Mit des Balles, nur fort mit a troppender Geschad, guck ich auf der Mammen. Was ist das? Ein new Treff. Es ist das, was du hast so lieb. Ich bin schon greit gewesen, euch schreien. Hurra! Eiscreme! Die Angina meine, hat mir aber bald gegeben in sich zu wissen mit der Stoch in Hals. Das hat dir der Doktor Säubel verschrieben, sagt ernst die Mame. Atter Eiscreme ist weil dir itzt die beste Refugie. The Old Well Underneath the Old Walnut Tree by Boris Sandler, translated from the Yiddish by Jordan Kutzik. Ice cream. Just the word alone, without even being able to lick it, taste it, and feel its cold, sweet burning on my tongue, makes my mouth water. Such a tasty, chocolate, buttery word, ice cream. It melts in my mouth and warms my heart. And although that tasty word is on my tongue, it is, as if despite me, intimately bound with another word, tonsillitis. This awkward, bitter word, which has its own nasty pharmacy smell, is also always on my tongue. Well, not on my tongue, but on my mother's. Mommy, I want ice cream. No more. You just had such bad tonsillitis. Yes, the two opposite words match much like my new pair of boots. The right one fits perfectly. I can walk and run and jump. The left one, though, pinches me so badly that I can't even take a step. I have to keep my toes curled the whole time. It's the middle of summer. I'm lying in bed. My neck is wrapped in my mother's woolen shawl, which has two things going for it. It warms me like a stove, and it itches as if an army of ants is biting me. My mother hands me a plate with a waffle cup, and it isn't empty. My heart pounds with excitement. It's the exact type of waffle cup that ice cream is sold in. I know those cups well. I've seen them lined up, one inside another, in the bird coop-like booth with plywood walls where a plump woman with a round face and red cheeks sells ice cream. Standing in her starched white apron, she uses a spoon to fill the waffle cup with ice cream before placing it on a scale. Squinting at the dancing pointer, she begins removing scoops of ice cream. I often stand there watching the scale from the other side of the window, barely able to contain myself. Enough! Leave it alone. None will be left for me. Enthusiastically, but with a little suspicion, I glance at my mother. What is it? Can't you guess? It's that thing you love so much. I am ready to yell, hooray, ice cream. But my tonsillitis announces itself with a stabbing pain in my throat. Dr. Soibel prescribed this, my mother explained. Ice cream is the best medicine for you now. Our family doctor is a gray-haired man of average height with sincere, childlike eyes that take everyone at their word. Every day you can see him walking down the street in his faded light coat, which was once apparently a dark blue. Over his black boots, he wears a pair of clumsy galoshes, and he keeps a worn-out leather portfolio held tightly against his body with his arm. The round wooden end of his stethoscope often sticks out from the portfolio's outer pocket. I know that inside of the portfolio's inner pocket is a pad with prescription sheets. Dr. Soibel is a regular visitor to our home due to my frequent bouts of tonsillitis. He only has to open the door of our veranda for me to know who is there. I recognize him not only by his soft sing-song voice, but also by the groaning squeak of his old boots. At first, you can hear the squeaking coming from the hallway as he stamps a few times, pulls off his galoshes, and removes his coat. Then the squeaking accompanies him into the kitchen, to our lead wash basin, where he rinses his hands with soap and dries them off with a towel left especially for him. By the time he finally approaches my mom, it seems more and more with each step he takes that it isn't his old boots that are squeaking, but rather something inside me. No, I'm not the least bit afraid of Dr. Soibel. He isn't going to give me any shots, God forbid. But he is a doctor, and doctors are well doctors.
Jordan, we've heard a lot from you last week about Yiddish and publishing, but let's focus more on your creative practice now. How do you approach translation? What was the process of translating this story in particular like?
So I studied translation theory in college, and it mostly put me to sleep. Some things were interesting, but mostly I was bored out of my mind. And the thing that really stuck with me, which people are going to be debating with literary translation to the end of time, is do you bring the text to the reader, or do you bring the reader to the text? How literal should the translation be? How much do you nativize? So I think all those issues are the same across languages, no matter what languages you're doing. There are things that there are expressions that don't translate and are often more interesting in the source language than in the target language. But do you want to make the character sound like they're speaking English in the year you're translating the text, or do you want to make the character sound like they're speaking the source language, but someone reading the target language can understand it? I think that there are times and places where both are appropriate. With Yiddish literature, if you look at the translations from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, there was clearly an assumption that only American Jews, and maybe even American Jews who also knew Yiddish passively, would be reading these texts. Because I read some of these translations today, and I'm thinking, who's the audience? This is a translation from Yiddish into some kind of inner language that's three quarters English and a quarter something else. That's not quite English. And I definitely want to avoid that. There are places where that's appropriate. There are a lot of books produced in the Orthodox world where somebody will write a book in Yiddish and then it will simultaneously appear in English and will appear in Hebrew. And if it's a religious book, it's going to be full of Hebrew, Yiddish, and Aramaic terms that are meaningless to someone without a traditional Jewish education. And that's perfectly fine for a particular audience. I'm translating for a general audience that may know far more about India or Pakistan or Guatemala than they do Romania in the 1950s. So that's definitely not my strategy. So when I take a translation, the first thing I do is I make sure I understand everything. And if I don't, with Boris's translation, Boris's stories, I have a very simple thing to do, which is to write him or give him a phone call. My Yiddish is quite good, but there are idiomatic things in his Yiddish that were particular to where he grew up. And then there are things just about life in the 1950s or the 1960s in Moldova, which I'm not going to get. One thing in this book is angina. Angina sounds like it should mean angina. And of course, it does mean angina, but colloquially and maybe not only colloquially, but certainly in the way the term was used, it was used both for heart pain and throat pain. And it was used specifically to refer to tonsillitis. The first time I read this story, I was thinking, this poor boy has a heart condition. He must have rheumatic fever or something. I talked to Boris. He said, oh, no, the tonsils. He has a problem with his tonsils. I said, oh, okay. Little things like that. I probably would have gotten, if it were not a story by Boris, I would have reached out to some different Yiddish writers and translators, and I would have figured it out eventually. But just translating quickly in the very first, very rough draft, I had it as angina every time, or angina question mark. So my first draft is very literal, reads more like Yiddish than English. The Yiddish word order, especially in dialogue, is a lot more flexible than English. So you will put whatever you're emphasizing in the sentence front, at the front of the sentence, and then bend the rest of the syntax around it. And you'll hear this kind of with stereotypical portrayals of Jews in comedy, especially from a while ago. I don't need a hole in the head. A hole in the head is not something I need right now, that type of thing. So my first draft reads like that. And then I put it aside for a week, and then I look at it again, and I write it as if it's the most standard American English, and everyone is speaking in kind of a 1960s broadcaster voice, how they'd say it. And then I compare it to the original again, and then I try and bring out the actual characters' voices as they'd sound in American English. So I've known Boris for 10 years, and I can imagine if he grew up in New York and spoke English as his first language, what would he have sounded like? And since the character in this story is him as a young child, I think that way and say, okay, what would a little Leave It to Beaver version of Boris and Sandler in a parallel universe sound like? That kind of thing. And then I try and get it more or less where it is. This story I did while I was doing a translation fellowship at the Yiddish Book Center. So I was workshopped it with a group, a few pages of it, and got a lot of helpful suggestions on kind of syntax, on making things flow a little more naturally. Little things, one kind of quirky linguistic thing was just in the first line. So ice, the standard word for ice cream in Yiddish is almost exactly like English, ice cream. Ice is ice, cream is cream. It's exactly the same, but it's written as one word. So the first line in Yiddish reads ice cream, just the one word, just that one simple word alone, or like that. And I was hung up on the fact that ice cream is two words in English. And so I had just those two words. And then my colleagues all said, it's really a compound word. It's really one word effectively. Just, it's a little kid, maybe a little kid wouldn't even know that it's spelled as one word, not spelled as one word, depending on how old they were. Just make it just the word alone. So I kept it like that. But if you're reading really carefully, maybe it's confusing. So there are always little things like that. This story has some particularly Jewish references, but I don't think anything that is difficult to understand. I think it's a story that works very well universally. Most readers don't have specific second generation Holocaust related trauma, but everybody has something in their parents' or their grandparents' past they feel that they've missed out on. I think that the best literature is universal in its particularness. I think if somebody writes a story that is about the average group of people in an average place, it's going to be incredibly boring. But if you write a story about your particular world or a world you're familiar with, a particular culture or subculture, there'll be things in it that are of interest and that have a universal appeal that reveal something about the human condition. And that's true of Boris's work. That's true of a lot of Yiddish literature. I think most people reading Yiddish literature in translation are Jewish people reading to learn about their family history. But just like any other literature, the best works are things people from any background can read and enjoy because of the universal human elements, even if the particular cultural context is specific to one people in one place and time.
And Boris, for you, what were your inspirations for The Old Well Underneath the Old Walnut Tree? How does it fit into your overall collection of short stories?
Every person begins with his or her childhood, his or her family, the street and the environment in which they were raised. But there's also another component, dreams. We children born after the Holocaust were scalded by dreams of war. We greatly regretted that the war had ended before we were born. Otherwise, we too could have fought against the enemy like we read in books, saw in movies, and most importantly, heard about in our parents' stories. In dreams, the reality that didn't survive the war was transformed into a tangible image before our eyes. Sometimes it was a grotesque, phantasmagorical image, which all efforts to save, to free from death's clutches, were doomed to predestined failure. This feeling of arriving too late, of being unable to save what came before, became embodied, for me, in a feeling of indebtedness, of duty. It's possible that my coming to Yiddish and creating in Yiddish also stems from this feeling.
Finally, I'd just like to ask, what's coming up next for both of you? What are your future projects? Let's start with Jordan.
Finished law school, passed the bar. I have another dozen of Boris's stories to do to make a full collection. So that's the goal, to have a complete book that kind of goes through his whole career and different periods from this story, which is the end of the Soviet period, through to what he's writing today about life in Brooklyn and everything in between. I have a lot of children's books in early stages that are very exciting, and I can't really talk about too much because they haven't been announced. We have a very cool book that will be coming out probably towards the end of next year, which is by a very prominent historian and linguist, Max Weinreich, who was the most important figure of Yiddish cultural and linguistic studies in the right before World War II and after World War II. And he wrote many books in many genres. He's almost entirely remembered for historical works and linguistic works. But his real interest before World War II was in the psychology of the Eastern European Jewish youth. There was a scholarship that Harvard gave in the early 1930s they said, you can come and study at any university in the United States. And of course, Harvard thought he's going to study at Harvard. And he chose to study at several different historical Black colleges. To study kind of a cross-cultural examination of African Americans in their early 20s from kind of intellectual backgrounds versus Polish Jews from a similar background and age and do a cross comparison. He had a really kind of wide-eyed view of many different areas of linguistics and social sciences and all that. So when his younger son, Gabby Weinreich, who sadly died a few months ago at the age of 95, when he turned 7, he wrote a children's book for Gabby in honor of his birthday. It's a fascinating little book because on the surface, it's a absurd story of what happens if the second letter of the alphabet, the base, the equivalent of the B, gets kicked out of the alphabet and you won't be able to spell anything. But what the story really is, it's a political allegory about the danger of witch hunts. And Weinreich was watching some of his colleagues who had moved to the USSR to take positions in kind of state-sponsored Yiddish academies. At first, they were doing great. And then when Stalin turned against not only the Jews, but against Ukrainians, against all of the state language academies and started liquidating and killing those people, Weinreich knew a lot of these people. On the one hand, it's a children's book for 5, 6, and 7-year-olds. On the other hand, it's a pretty sophisticated political allegory reflecting on the tragic circumstances going on at that time. And it also has a lot of great wordplay. And Gabby Weinreich, who moved to the United States and became a leading expert on acoustics and specifically the acoustics of the violin. He made a wonderful translation of the book into English just for his grandkids, and it was never published for a wider audience. So we have a book where the hero of the book, age 7, becomes the book's translator in real life. So it's this really cool, wonderful dynamic. So it's called The Story of the Big Bad Bays, which is a pun. Bays is both means angry in Yiddish, but it's also the name of the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet in the Yiddish pronunciation, better known as Bet these days. So that's a really cool one. And we're going to have an original children's book as well about stuffed animals who are abandoned in an attic and find a new generation of children children they're missing when come to visit and they're in their 20s and 30s and have their own kids. The kind of a universal story of childhood and growing up, but from the perspective of stuffed animals and toys rather than the perspective of the children themselves. And beyond that, I have a list of literally hundreds of books and short stories. And even in a parallel universe where I could do this full time and had a budget of $1 million, you could not touch. I said that 90% of Yiddish children's literature is bad. The 10% that's good is still more than anybody or any 10 publishers could publish. It's a lot. And if I ever get the time, which won't be for a while, but I'd love to, I want to do a big anthology of Yiddish journalism going from the 1860s straight through to the 2020s, kind of just a kaleidoscopic view of world events. Writers of many different political and religious backgrounds reacting to events in real time, literary reportages. And honestly, you could do entire books just of some of the great Yiddish journalists, Yeshua Perle, Mordechai Sonnen, my late friend and mentor, Yitzhak Luden, who published volumes of their own work. But I want to just, instead of doing that, I'm going to do one story by 100 different writers with a short bio and try to just give like a sense of, rather, you can't do a comprehensive things, but just like the gamut of just fascinating things. There was a very well-known poet named Morris Rosenfeld in the United States. He was known as the kind of the sweatshop poet. And he's remembered because he wrote a bit in English, and a few of his poems are still popular. His English language poems are still popular, but he was an extraordinary journalist. And he wrote the searing op-ed when the Titanic went down. The paper he wrote for was the same paper I wrote for, the Forward. The Forward. And for weeks, the headline of the Forward was Jacob Astor missing, this rich person missing, this super wealthy person missing. What everyone forgets about the Titanic is a third of the passengers were poor immigrants, mostly Jews, Poles, and Irish, coming to the United States as if it were any other boat, and they were locked down in steerage and none of them survived. So he wrote this essay kind of attacking his own colleagues for not mentioning the people, the common man in the steerage. And I thought about that article a lot when we had the tragic sinking of the submersible at the same time as the migrant boat going down. And 800 migrants went down in the water, and it didn't get 1/50th of the attention of the submersible going down. And these parallels don't change. History doesn't repeat, but it damn well rhymes. So I think that'll be of interest to a lot of people, just seeing how Yiddish journalists from across a century and a half saw world events and what they have to tell us about our life and our time. So if I ever, you know, maybe in 20, 30 years when I retire, that'll be my big project, because that's an overwhelmingly huge project. And journalism does not get translated. There's so many great journalists, but very few people read stories about old events. It's a niche market, even in English. I'd love to do it whether there are 50 readers or 5,000 readers. Having worked as a journalist in Yiddish and seeing these people as my literary influences and people I read to try and improve my own stylistics in the Yiddish language, I'm really committed to not only bringing this out in English, but also republishing all these stories in Yiddish as well.
And how about you, Boris?
I'd just like to add that there is a small but very talented and diverse group of young Yiddish writers today. It's obviously a joy for me that when I look around at the field of contemporary Yiddish literature, I see that the road will not end with my generation. There are others following behind me with whom I can break bread. Thank you for your interest in Yiddish literature and for your interesting question.
You've been listening to an interview with Yiddish author Boris Sandler and Yiddish translator Jordan Kutzik. They've discussed their work on the story The Old Well Underneath the Old Walnut Tree, and they've provided a wealth of information on Yiddish literature, Yiddish language, and Yiddish publishing. I'd really like to thank Jordan Kutzik for all of his assistance with these two interviews, as well as the publication of Boris Sandler's short stories. It is also thanks to Jordan that I was connected with Faroese Publishing House for two children's stories that will appear in the April 2024 issue of Traffic in Europe, Recrudescence. Thank you so much, Jordan, for your collaboration, as well as your contribution to essential new literature of lesser-known languages of Europe. Without people like Jordan, we would not be able to continue existing. Thank you all for tuning in this week, and have a great day.